Welcome to Poetica's podcast series of Australian poetry. Mike Ladd with you. Blackwater features the poetry of Robert Adamson. Born in Sydney in 1943, Robert Adamson has published 20 books of poetry to date. The first, Canticles on the Skin, in 1970. Other works include the multi-award-winning The Clean Dark, The Language of Oysters, with photographs by Juno Jeames, and his autobiographical work, Wards of the State. While he's often described as a lyric and nature poet, he's also a political writer, addressing the topics of violence, drugs and prison life, social intolerance and environmental degradation. Robert edited New Poetry magazine from 1971 and established Paperbark Press with Juno Jeames and Michael Wilding in 1987. Since childhood, Robert Adamson has had a strong connection with the Hawkesbury River north of Sydney. Producer Libby Douglas and sound engineer Philip Allman travelled to the Hawkesbury and spent 2 days with Robert and his wife, the photographer Juno Jeames. They recorded Robert in his home and on his boat, reading his poetry and talking about his life. This feature mixes soundscapes of the Hawkesbury River, oyster farming and fishing, with Robert talking about the influences on his work, his family, his desire to become an ornithologist, and the first time he heard Bob Dylan. And just a warning that there's a brief instance of language that may offend some listeners.
When the tide moves again, comes up over the point here and spills into Parsley Bay, goes over the river's torn and trails, your breath becomes tidal atmosphere. It heals deeply, thoroughly. Then you begin to understand that the river is like a blank page. You enter it differently, shape it as you would a new thought. First vaguely, with phrases, then sentences, until finally its language starts talking. When the river covers a bay, you know its weight soothes, healing the savaged earth. And the tide begins to make music as it covers oysters. As it climbs over the rocks, its song fills the valley, a baroque tinkling tune, its lyrics in a language easy to comprehend. Of course, it's the imagination weaving the river song. Your mind's invention is playing you as the tide begins to ebb, and you see smooth mud cuts healing, and there is wind song to dance now with your voice. I didn't like human beings for a long time when I was a kid. I ended up in prison by the time I spent my 21st birthday in prison. And every time I got out from one of those kind of institutions, I would come back to the river. I started writing poetry because I was a terrible folk singer. Dylan's voice came echoing out of the sandstone wall. I'd be dead if I didn't have this river. When I was young, I wanted to be an ornithologist. At school, I was hopeless at everything except drawing and composition, you know, what they call English composition. And when I was about 10, they send those guys around. In those days, they were always men, careers advisors, what were they called? Vocational guidance officer. And this guy interviewed me and I said, I definitely want to be an ornithologist. I'm not going to be anything else. And he looked at all my records and exams and said, well, just forget that, son, you know. There's no way you can do that because you've got to be good at mathematics. And I thought, what has mathematics got to do with birds? He said, you'll have to do a science degree and I don't think you'll be able to. So then I decided, oh, well, I won't worry about school. I'll go and get a job in the zoo and work from the bottom up, like cleaning cages and things. Well, I left school when I was 13. I went to Taronga Zoo and said, I want a job in the zoo looking after birds. And the guy said, well, come back when you get your leaving certificate. I said, what? He said, you've got to have a leaving certificate. And I said, yeah, you've got to have a leaving certificate to clean bird cages. And he said, yeah, that's right. So I couldn't even get a job, you know, in the zoo. That was the beginning of this, me rebelling, you know, wildly. I stole a bird of paradise from Taronga Zoo when I was 15, took it home and put it with my pigeons and parrots. I was sent to a boys' home for doing that. When the lady next door rang up the RSPCA and said I had a kookaburra with clipped wings. Its wings weren't clipped, it was just tame. It used to ride on my shoulder on my bike. But I just brought it up since it was a baby. And she rang up the RSPCA and they came when I was at school and asked my mother, and she said, oh, he's got all sorts of birds down there. And in the backyard, I had this really big backyard. And they went and found this bird of paradise. So when I got home, there were two detectives from North Sydney Police Station waiting there for me. They said to my mother, where did he get it? She said, oh, he caught it in the park. He catches them all in the park. And the copper said, we don't think you caught this bird in the park, Bob. I said, oh, yeah, no, there's lots of them down there.
The night heron. Midnight. My mind is full of ink tonight. I'm drawing up some endings to make a few last marks. Life's complete. You are just a part of the mix. A pain cocktail. A dash of white spirit. Some polvules of duloxine swallowed with black label apple juice as I cut and paste my past. Life is sweet. Out there, the night, the stars in technicolor, a half moon, two half moons, the black branches of a mangrove tree, jasmine heavy on the night air. I feel all right, even here, suspended in a humid room, with another summer to get through. I write down words, they all seem fake. So I crack them open, a night writing letters to the future and the past. If you could look into the present, you might see this pudgy figure at the desk, throwing back double shots of gin, fumbling for cigarettes and a light, writing the word political in a black thin calligraphy, wearing a pair of digital blinkers set on zero. Outside, the night heron swings in from the heaven and cuts through the aluminium light. See the cream underwing, grey breast, the grey overcoat. Watch it hit the pocket of hot air. Listen as it wheels on silence, glides into the black calm above the swamp and lands collecting in the creek. I met a young girl who was an orphan. She was one of those girls that came from Liverpool and assisted passage. She came here with her mother, and then her mother pissed off and left her alone. And I took this girl home to my mother, who wasn't at all impressed with her. And I said, could she stay in my room until we get it together? And my mother said, get her out of this house before your father gets home. So I put her in the car and we ran away to Queensland. So I got arrested for carnal knowledge in the end. She was underage. And every time I got out from one of those kind of institutions, I would come back to the river. My grandfather lived just down the point there. And he was illiterate. He hadn't been to school himself. And he didn't see the need for me to go to school. In those days it was wonderful, there was no communication, they didn't have a telephone, there was no electricity, and he wouldn't tell my parents where I was, so I just worked with him on his fishing trawler and hung out until, you know, eventually my parents would come up, then drag me back to whatever it was I was doing, mainly pastry cooking. I ended up getting a prize for the best wedding cake at the Royal Easter Show. I decorated a wedding cake at my job. That was in the early 50s. I would have been about 17. Yeah, yeah. When I was in Long Bay, they installed speakers in the cells and they turned the radio on for 2 hours each night after dinner. And in those days, Peter, Paul and Mary were singing Blowing in the Wind, and that was number one. Vietnam was going on, I think. And John Laws didn't like Bob Dylan for some reason. And you know what he's like, he said, here's Peter, Paul and Mary, and he played a few bars of that, and he said, now here's the guy that wrote the song, just listen to this guy, he can't even sing. He's some left-wing maniac. And, whatever John Laws says, his tirade against this Bob Dylan character. And so he put it on, and Dylan's voice came echoing out of the sandstone wall like this amazing, prophet Ezekiel or someone from thousands of years ago, this amazing voice. I just loved it. I just completely loved it. And I thought, I'll be a singer. That's what I'll do. I went down into the exercise yard the next morning and said to the other crimps, look, did you hear that last night? Wasn't it fantastic? And they all said, it was terrible, he can't sing. They're exactly like John Laws. They're very conservative, most people in prison. They like Frank Sinatra and country music and stuff like that. So I thought, what is this? Like I was an outsider amongst outsiders. So I decided I'd write songs, and I was talking to a Jesuit priest who'd come to see me once a week. He got me a guitar and I started playing chords and I wrote a couple of songs. And he came back and I said, I've written three songs. And he took them away, came back a week later and said, I'm sorry to say, Bob, that these aren't songs. They're, and I was devastated. He said, but they're poems. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, great. I didn't really want to write poems. The gathering light. Morning shines on the cowling of the Yamaha, locked to the stern of the boat. Spears of light shoot away from the gunmetal grey enamel. Now I wait for God to show, instead of calling him a liar. I have just killed a mulloway, 85 pounds, 30 years old. The huge mauve silver body trembles in the hull. Time whistles around us, an invisible flood tide that I let go while I take in what I have done. It was not a fight. I was drawn to this moment, and the physical world drains away. We enter a golden calm. The sun is a hole in the sky, a porthole. You can see turbulence out there, old, wheeling colours and their dark forces. But here on the surface of the river, where I cradle the great fish in my arms and smell its pungent death, a peace I have never experienced, a luminous absence of time, pain, sex and thought, nothing but the light. When I got out of prison, I met Brett Whiteley, and he loved Dylan just as much as I did, and we became instant friends, and everything we did was judged by Dylan as a benchmark. And a new Bob Dylan record had just come out, and I had a Ford Custom line in. He said, let's go and get the new Dylan record. And we jumped in my car. I didn't have a cassette player. I didn't have a radio in it. And we bought the record, and he said, just go in there, man. And we went into one of those places that sell car radios, and he said, put in a car radio, put it in really straight away, man. We want it done in a half an hour. If you can do it in a half an hour, we'll buy it. And he installed a radio cassette player, the best one you can get, in my car, and paid for it, just so we could listen to Bob Dylan on the way across the Harbour Bridge. We're on this looping road. It's narrow. The car's fast and expensive. Too fast, considering we've downed a few. there's a woman singing Bob Dylan well. Too well, as the line about what you want cuts through the climate control, mixing the smell of jonquils with hot bodies. Things are looking dangerous. Then suddenly the waters are before us. The surface, a black raw silk all ironed out and drifting through a fishing light. We are still in the car and quibbling as a wild duck makes an evanescent wake across the phosphorus tide. The woman turns to Brett and says, "Is this decadence?" "No, man," he mutters, "just reflected glory up shit creek."
Well, they get the eggs of the oysters. They call them spats. They put these wire frames out on the river, and at a certain time of the year, the oysters, like coral, you know, they lay their eggs and they release all this sperm. Oysters are male and female. They can either be male or female. And then the oyster farmers take the spats down to a part of the river where they fatten them up, where they grow when they're very tiny. They put them into these long mesh cylinders so that the fish can't eat them, the bream can't eat them, and they move them from place to place about on the river where different types of plankton and different conditions are according to the what stage of development it's at. They move it to a richer source of plankton that they eat, or parts of the tide where it rises and leaves them above the tide. They have to spend some part of their day out of the water as well as in the water. Some of these places have still got mounds where the Aboriginal people used to eat them. Middens of I'll show you some back there. They're really huge, where they would sit for years and years after year, just eating oysters and throwing the oysters into the one place. And they're huge mounds, like some of them are 10 foot high.
Chicken and half serving of lamb.
Yeah, that's good.
Just sort of had a communal feed.
Yeah. Over a period of years, I worked up to the oyster farmers, which are a very tight knit mob, usually families who have been here for five generations, you know? And because they knew Bob's grandfather, and he was very respected as a fisherman, and because they knew the story of this wild young man poet who grew up around here, and I was his wife, you know. So that was gave me an entree that might have been very difficult otherwise. And eventually I got up the thing to go over to one of the oyster farmers and say, "Is it okay if I hang out here for a while and photograph just the process of what goes on?" And it was so amazing, you know. I found this meticulous order within the sheds and the way they hang the belts, and the young men appear like, you know, young knights to me. I saw them in this particular way. And then they said, "Would you like to come out with us because we're moving the oyster beds?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do that. When's that?" And they said, "Well, you got to be here at 4 o'clock in the morning, ready to go." So I was, 4 o'clock in the morning, and then, you know, the thing just takes off and whew, you're up to some part of the river you've never seen before.
They've got these punts with 200 horsepower.
They're really fast. And they know the river backwards.
Flat punts that just slide over the surface. They go really fast.
And while I was doing
this, because you've got to travel big distances to cultivate the oysters.
And it's all got to be on the tide, so you get up there at the right time.
It's a race against the tide all the time.
You know, sitting up out of the water, and they can wash them or move them or... Oh, it's hard work. Mm. And then at a certain point, when an oyster's grown to a certain stage, they'll move them to what's called the fattening ground. They lift the racks up, and put them on the boat and go whizzing up to another part of the river, and they have to get them up there and lay them out in the new beds, all within that small space within the tidal shift.
The language of oysters. Charles Olson sat back in his oyster shed, working with words, mostly in a great sweat of being, seeking to bind in speed. Looked at his sheaf of pages, each word an oyster culled from the fattening grounds of talk. They were nurtured from day one, from the spat fields to their shucking. Words, oysters plump with life. On Mooney Creek, the men stalk the tides for corruption. They spend nights in tin shacks that open at dawn onto our great brown river. On the right tide, they ride out into the light in their punts, battered slabs of aluminium with 100-horse Yamahas on the stern, hammering tightly away, padded by high tech, sucking mud into the cooling systems. The motors leave a jet of hot piss in their wake. These powerheads indicate the quality of the morning's hum. New boys don't wake from dreams where clinkers crack, where mud sucks them under, their grandfather's hands fumbling accurately, loosening the knots. Back at the bunker, the Hessian sacks are packed ready, and the shells grow into sliding white foothills. A freezing mist clenches your fingers, the brown steam, now cold as fire, plunge in and wash away last night's grog. In middle morning, stinging you, wanting the week to fold away till payday. On the bank, the spur-winged plovers stroll in pairs, their beak wattle chipped by frost. Each day they ping at crack of sun. Stalking for corruption? Signs. Blue algae drifts through your brother's dream of gold coasts, golf courses, the first settlement. My mother's family were Neutral Bay builders, and they were kind of Scottish Presbyterians, and I didn't get on so well with them. But my father's family were Irish Catholics, and they were the illiterate fishermen that lived up here. They were the ones I loved. And so Neutral Bay represented to me this kind of suppression and doing the right thing and, you know, school and all that stuff. And up here it was birds and fishing and getting drunk and singing songs. And my dad was a rodeo rider and buck jumper, and he was doing some kind of, I think the Sydney show was on, and he was riding, he had a Palomino, and he was riding it along Balmoral Beach, and that's where he met Mum. She was going to Neutral Bay school, and her family were fairly well off, you know, North Shore sort of, and he just said, come for a ride, and rode off with Mum. And she got pregnant, and that was me. And then he went back and said, I'm going to marry her, and much to my mother's family's horror.
What a wonderful story.
But she stuck with him and by him. And yeah. So it was this complete, like, Irish Catholic sort of fisherman drinkers and Presbyterian builders, like, getting on in the world. It's that's why I'm kind of schizoid. The moon is just so important to me. Like last night I went fishing because the dew fish come when there's a full moon. There's been a week either side of a full moon, and last night was the last chance I had to go because I've got all these commitments coming up. And even though I knew you were coming, I thought, oh, I'll still do it. And I felt better. It clears your head out. And it is connected to food because I catch the fish, and as the moon goes through its cycles, you know, I know exactly what's happening in the river, the birds and the fish, and, you know, either side of low tide, an hour either side, you can't come in because of the mud flat. So you're in tune with it all. It's just, oh, I don't know, it's just the cycles of your life are in, and not thrown about. I'd be dead if I didn't have this river. I couldn't have stopped drinking for a start if I didn't come up here. Oh, this is a good one. My fishing boat. Mum and Dad are at it again, in the room next to mine. Their terrible sobbing comes through the damp wall. They fight about something I have done. I get out of bed and go down the yard to the river, push my boat out into the black and freezing bay. Under the mangroves that smell like human shit, I move along my secret channel, my hands blistered from rowing, slipped with blood. Around the cove I tie up on a mangrove. It rains harder. All I catch are catfish here. I have them sliding about in the belly of the boat. They are the most ugly looking things in the world.
And started writing. A combination of Bob Dylan, Dylan Thomas and Hopkins. And then I discovered Shelley, and he was my hero. Everything about Shelley I just adopted. I even became a vegetarian. I'm very visually orientated, I think. It goes back to what I was saying. I really wanted to be an artist, an ornithologist, and so I use visual things very, very much. I try to paint with words, I guess. But then the music is very important because I think of them as songs. I think of my poems as songs that are for the page rather than for singing.
That mist is called the serpent's breath, and it only comes up rarely in the winter. And Johnny Griffith, a really good friend of ours and a very old friend of ours, he's known that I was waiting. I wanted to photograph through that mist and, you know, to tell when is it going to come up? When is it going to arise?
Tomorrow,
so we actually,
4 a.m.,
the mist is on, we're going out. Bob and I will fish it, you photograph. So we went out and it was amazing because we could hardly see. It was right, starts off very low. And it was so eerie the way it rose as the
large format camera, which I don't often
the
use.
Mist rose so gradually.
And I said, no, I have to go out for that.
So it was a small boat, as I say, and I was on the front of it with a tripod on the front of the boat. And I said, Griffo, just hold my ankle because, you know, there's no guaranteeing what's going to happen. Well, in the meantime, I'm taking forever, as I do with a large format camera, jiggling and getting the spirit levels right and composing within the frame and where's the mist now? It's moved around to there and move the boat and it's all this.
All of a sudden this brim
appears in the top. Don't move! Don't fucking move! You know, click, there it was. That's the cover of The Clean Dark. And then coming around this way, suddenly the oyster shack started to appear, and I knew that was just one of those magic rolls, you know? It was amazing.
Phasing out the mangroves. Now it has been drawn up. The swamp will be filled. Measurements have been taken. Now come perspectives. Balsa wood models grow out from colour photography. It was life, say the eyes of the elderly, replaced by concrete geometries. The great hunched mangroves will no longer tend the instincts of the kingfishers. Bent glass and metal domes shall hover above mud that fed soldier crabs. Windsurfers will be flightless pelicans, and clouds of sandfly will rise around neon calligraphy. Where old wood knocks on jetties will be echoes of graphite. And tending the keyboards on decks of the river craft, the swamp children speaking in a language of arithmetic in cracked syllables. Basically, I believe in God, but I've never been able to find a church or a religion that I can actually believe in.
I can't go much further than Christ as a model for my philosophy. I mean, I really think Jesus Christ was a great philosopher, and I pretty much believe what he says. I became a converted Catholic when I got married with my first wife, who was a Catholic, and I didn't know what that entailed. She said, oh, my family want me to be married in the Catholic Church. I said, oh, that's no problem. I'll just become a Catholic. She said, wow, would you do that? I said, yeah, sure. No problems. I'll just... And so I eventually became a Catholic and got married in the Catholic Church. That took about a year. But then I couldn't really believe it. I could understand it intellectually, but I just couldn't get my head around the idea that Christ was God. I just couldn't. Everything's too vast for that, for me to believe that there's just one God and Jesus Christ was his son, and there's this huge giant universe out there. I just couldn't really do it. I couldn't make that extra leap. I guess I'm a pantheist. I believe in nature more than anything. I always try to place what I do in history. So if I'm writing a poem about fishing now, I'll think about what fishing was on this river going back for millions of years. Now you go back to the Aboriginal people who fished on this river, and there's lots of rock carvings around here. You'll see a picture of a mulloway, and that's usually where the mulloway live. And in this next poem, it's called The Wild Colonial Boys. It's thinking about the first white people that came to the river and how they basically fucked it up. Wild colonial boys. Musk ducks and the plump wonga pigeon were knocked from the sky in blood sport, left to rot. Then afterwards, in firelight, were the games, all various forms of gambling. In the mist, you'd hear knuckle bones rattle in their cotton pockets, or darned in conversation, obscene words slurred by badly brewed alcohol. Never song, but garbled recitation, coughed half chance. Whatever fed the imagination was like a yellowness. It showed in diverse activities, from plucking ducks to the way they slept in postures of loose decadence. The river was a flood of their refuse, a smear of thick waste through the countryside. After storms and at low tide, you'd see the details of their hate. The score, a tally, and what they called their stake, the sacred remnants of an ancient tribe's estate. Although this river has been affected pretty much by humans, it really hasn't. There's still a prehistoric river right outside my back door. And it's basically unchanged. There's as many fish here and birds here as there was when I was 12, if not more. There are more birds here now than there were when I was 12. It's a really healthy river. It's so the tides come in and wash it out. This is kind of like when I go up to the news agency and see Brett Whiteley dead, and then I come back, and when I come back down, I was so shocked. The guy in the bottle shop drove me back down in my car because he met Brett. And I went in there and I said, Brett Whiteley's dead. He said, didn't you know? I said, no. He went, oh, fuck, sit down, just because he knew what it would mean. And I said, give us a bottle of vodka. He said, do you really want a bottle of vodka? I don't think so, Bob. Because he knew I'd stopped drinking. And this was the poem about that. And when I came back down here, I saw the bowerbirds and all the birds that Brett painted, you know, like it was more like his birds than real birds. And so rather than just write about him, I wrote about the birds and him. Windy Drop Down Creek. It was a blustering winter. I saw his name in headlines, flapping outside a shop next to the chemist. Death turns up and life goes on, incredibly. What can you feel when the day turns to stone? On the river, the bower birds dart through the mangroves in little troops, the females trailing the colour of their olive backs in streaks, painting the air with olive ribbons, whirring bowerbird light in quick curves around their bowers flecked with the blue tokens of their sex, the bits of jagged indigo, pegs of ultramarine, spikes in cobalt, the dilatory lapis lazuli of a male's eye, the pure blue deeper than cold blood in a block vein. I remembered heroin's white abyss and couldn't speak, so turned with my little packet from the chemist, walking out whistling into the asphalt square of a car park, then drove around the block to the grog shop. Oh, vodka, simplify the world. While down in Calabash Creek, the birds whirred above their bowers, trailing silky olive ribbons, pushing time back and forth, uncovering and covering and calling up blue light. I mean, people say to me, oh, gee, you've had a hard life. You've been to boys' homes and reform schools and prison. But I think if I hadn't grown up in Neutral Bay and had access to places like Balmoral and the Hawkesbury River, I would have been a big mess. But when I was ever in any deep trouble, or serving solitary confinement or something like that in Long Bay, I just visualise what it was like growing up in Balmoral or Neutral Bay or the Hawkesbury and think, oh, yeah, like I'd be suicidal sometimes. Think, no, no, I better not die yet. I've got to go one more time on the river.
In Poetica's podcast series, we've been listening to Black Water, the poetry of Robert Adamson. Production was by Libby Douglas, and the sound engineer was Philip Ullman, with music by David Bates. Robert Adamson's The Golden Bird, New and Selected Poems, is published by Black Ink. This project has been assisted by the Australian Government through the Australia Council for the Arts, its arts funding and advisory body.